Hello and welcome to Stephanomics, the podcast that brings the global economy to you. My name is Tom Orlick. I'm the chief economist for Bloomberg, and this Halloween week, with regular host Stephanie Flanders busy putting the finishing touches to her modern monetary theory costume, I'm stepping in as master of ceremonies. In keeping with the spirit of the season, we have a Frankenstein's monster of a show for you, stitching together some of the scariest risks in the global economy. In a bit, we'll hear from Logan Wright of Rhodium Group and Bloomberg's own David Chu on why the ghost town problem that has long haunted China's economy is coming to a head. To start though, Bloomberg's own Tom Hancock has gone trick-or-treating at the Hong Kong headquarters of Evergrande, one of the developers that built all that empty property. Let's see what candy he collected.
I've come to the headquarters of China Evergrande Group in Hong Kong, the epicenter of a burgeoning debt crisis that has sharply slowed growth in the Chinese economy. The sides of the 26-story building are plastered with advertisements for Evergrande's luxury property developments. But it's the headquarters itself which has been up for sale this year. Evergrande tried to raise $2 billion by selling it off to pay debt, but the deal hasn't progressed. Evergrande staff who walk the lobby's marble floor and take elevators to their offices face an uncertain future. In a cafe next to the building's lobby, Evergrande staff meet over coffees while soft piano music plays. More than a month after entering its acute phase, the financial drama at the company that had been China's largest property developer until recently is far from over. After waiting about a month for an interest payment, some of Evergrande's dollar bondholders received their money over the weekend, allowing the company to avoid a default for now. But investors have little insight into how long Evergrande can continue to pay its bills.
The bonds initially had a bit of a pop and then sort of very quickly came back down to almost unchanged on the day.
That's Monica Sao of Triada Capital, an asset manager.
I think that it made sense for them to pay this just pretty much about a day before the end of the grace period in order to kick the can down the road while they figure out a comprehensive resolution to this whole saga.
Like many in the market, Sao sees the hand of China's government behind the scenes. Evergrande's status as China's biggest dollar bond issuer means whether it pays its bills will help determine how easy it is for other Chinese companies to access overseas lending in the future.
So the payment of this coupon, I would assume, does involve the government, including the PBOC, in order to maintain stability of the whole financial system. I think that much is sort of clear to the market.
The heart of Evergrande's troubles are its high debt burden. It counts more than $300 billion in liabilities and a slowdown in sales, attributable to the Chinese state itself. According to Zhu Ning, a former advisor to China's central bank, the Chinese government is trying to reduce the economy's dependence on real estate. He argues that a constant expectation of rising prices among households has created a bubble that threatens financial stability. But in the process of trying to deflate the bubble by slowing housing sales, officials are undermining the finances of huge companies like Evergrande. That in turn creates a threat to financial stability.
If you crack down the bubble, you would create financial risks on its own. But if you don't, you wouldn't be able to convince the market that you really mean it. So I think that's the inherent challenge Chinese regulator, Chinese government face.
Evergrande sales fell by a whopping 97% during China's October holidays, usually a peak period for home buying, as the government told banks to limit mortgage lending, and buyers also worried about Evergrande's ability to complete its construction projects. Zhu Ning believes that Beijing will continue to try to slow housing sales until households lose their expectations that the government will always step in to support house prices.
I think the end of it is to have the market, have the households to have a fairly steady expansion of the housing market. But I don't think we're reaching that point yet.
Evergrande needs to focus more on selling off its considerable assets to keep servicing its huge debt pile, since it has less money coming in the door from home buyers. The trouble is, it's having difficulties finding any buyers for those as well. Evergrande has also tried to sell its property management arm, which charges homeowners fees for organizing services like security and cleaning. It hoped that that would bring in $2.6 billion, but talks about that also ended without a deal. Evergrande's founder and chairman, Hui Kaiyan, has always been a risk taker. He was born into grinding poverty in the central province of Henan in the 1950s and founded his property company just as China began to create a commercial housing market in the late 1990s. 2 decades later, in 2017, he was China's second richest man. So far, Hui has been low-key about the details of Evergrande's finances, avoiding media engagements. However, local press accounts suggest he is sticking with the kind of big, bold bets that have defined his career. The Securities Times reported that Hui plans to scale down real estate operations and won't buy much land for another 10 years. The new focus? Designing and manufacturing electric vehicles. The company got into the new energy vehicles business a couple of years ago, but has yet to manufacture a single car. Evergrande faces more tests in the coming weeks as the grace periods on more bonds expire. The fate of one of the world's largest real estate firms and the world's biggest real estate market still hangs in the balance. For Bloomberg News, I'm Tom Hancock in Hong Kong.
Scary stuff for Evergrande bondholders. And with Evergrande emblematic of broader problems in an overbuilt and overleveraged property sector, scary stuff also for China's economy and financial system as a whole. To get into those broader issues, I'm joined now by Logan Wright, a director at Radium Group and veteran analyst of China's financial system, and Bloomberg's David Chu, both of them dialing in from Hong Kong. Logan, let me start with you. Why is a downturn in real estate potentially such a big problem for China?
I think it's a big problem largely because just of the size of the property sector within China's economy, which most analysts estimate between 20 and 25% of GDP. Overall property sales in China, in terms of just the pre-construction sales, are as high as 15.7 trillion yuan over the last year, over the last 12 months. And so if you hypothetically look in the future, and if property sales decline by, let's say, 20% over the next year, and prices are down by, say, 10%, that's a huge gap that it's very difficult for developers to make up. It's a gap as high as 3.5% of GDP. It is not an imbalance that is easily remedied by policy. So this is one reason that the potential costs of such a property downturn that exemplified by Evergrande's difficulties are so significant.
And it's not just a growth risk we're talking about here, is it? A slump in the property sector could mean defaults on loans and end up in a financial crisis, a Lehman moment for China, if you will. Logan, how could that play out?
The more likely scenario that we would be concerned about in terms of financial distress in China stems through local governments and the difficulties of property developers continuing to slow down their purchases of land, which would add to financial stress among China's local governments, which depend heavily upon land sales for revenue and repaying their own significant debt burdens. So what you could see is if you have a continued slowdown in land purchases, you could have a rise in financial distress at smaller banks that lend to these local government financing vehicles, which have really led the expansion in China's debt over the past decade, which were also essential to funding the investment that has taken place.
David Chu, you've worked inside the People's Bank of China, and not just inside the People's Bank of China, but inside the Financial Stability Division of China's Central Bank, the group which cares most and focuses most on this kind of problems. How do you think China's policymakers are thinking about what's going on with Evergrande and some of the broader risks that Logan has described?
For China's financial sector, the banking sector is the key. Particularly the big banks are the key. They are the natural firewall for the financial crisis or financial risks because they have the guarantee from the government. So, for example, if you deposit the money into ICBC, that means you are depositing it with the government. So that is the ICBC and the big banks, they are sovereign credit. So this makes them a natural firewall during a credit crisis or credit risk. Remember what happened 30 years ago in 1990s, China's banks used to have 30% NPL ratio, but the banks were still surviving. And that tells us how confident people are to the banking sector. So the principle for us is if the banking sector remains good and they still have the credibility, things will be good. So that is the most ultimate backdrop or backstone for all the argument.
Logan, help me out with one crucial question before we get back to the substance of this. Evergrande or Evergrande?
I've heard both translations. The one I hear most often is Evergrande, but technically it's Hung Da. So it's a question of whatever English translation you prefer, the Chinese will still operate.
Historically, I went with Evergrande, but Evergrande seems to have much more of a dramatic flourish to it. So I think I'm going to put the accent on the E going forwards.
Fair enough.
So Logan, I mean, David makes an important point, doesn't he? There is a powerful firewall in the financial system in China, which is the credibility of the big banks. And as long as the ICBCs and the China Construction Banks of the world are solid, it's difficult to imagine a systemic crisis in China. Do you agree with that point? And what could happen in your view to start eroding confidence, not just in a property developer or a local bank, but in the giant state banks which dominate the system?
I mean, I think it's very improbable that giant state banks would suddenly lose confidence among the local population. But the concern I would have is in state guarantees being eroded over time. The issue in China's financial system has been that the system expanded when there was a high degree of moral hazard that was pervasive throughout a number of different asset markets. So the idea was that even when there was financial stress that occurred, investors didn't need to protect themselves because they could always count on Beijing to step in the case of any financial stress. We saw this during even the stock market meltdown in 2015. We saw this during the interbank market turmoil of 2013. And so that assumption, that track record of interventions over time, created the impression that there would always be some sort of government support. But that is changing, and it had to change. In fact, it was natural that guarantee would change because Beijing really had no interest in defending these very risky and peripheral parts of the financial system when the shadow banking system, when peer-to-peer lending networks started expanding. And as those guarantees have been eroded, it causes investors to start questioning where those Beijing's guarantees will truly extend, where they will stop.
Looking longer term, Logan, China has to transition away from property as a driver of growth. You mentioned that 25% contribution of property to GDP. That has to come down. That's going to be a painful process, isn't it?
I would think so. The issue is just that when an industry is that large, there's no obvious replacement when something that goes from powering the economy becomes a meaningful drag on the economy. You can talk about transitioning growth models, but that becomes a longer term process and it requires the costs of the previous investment to be paid and new investment decisions to be made, which take time to be productive. So it does mean that, you know, whatever you're thinking about China's long-term growth trajectory becoming, it probably involves that being a couple of percentage points lower in the immediate future.
David, the last word to you. We've already seen China's economy really screech to a halt in the third quarter. If you look at the quarter-on-quarter growth rate, just 0.2%, way down from numbers we used to see in the pre-COVID era. Do you share Logan's view that working through these deep problems is going to require a period of lower growth?
Before answering this question, we should think of one thing. It is why the authorities are so tough to the real estate sector for the past couple of years. So I think we need to think of it in the bigger picture. And in my mind, I think that the top leaders, they realized that China needs the transition, and they are willing to endure a period of slower growth in the next couple of years. That is the price for transition. I think that is what in their mind. So this can explain what happened in the past several quarters after China recovered from the COVID-19, that they accelerated the reform and the transition, and many of the tightened policies issued. I think they view it a time window for the transition, and they are willing to pay some price for that. But on the other hand, I think they won't allow the growth to break the bottom line. I think one of the bottom line is employment. So if we see the rise of the unemployment, we will see some policies to be made to stimulate the economy.
Well, if we have to sum up such a complex discussion, I guess we can say that Evergrande is probably not going to be China's Lehman moment. A financial crisis is not an immediate prospect, but a period of lower growth as the economy works through the problems of overbuilding and overcapacity is a very real prospect. David Chu, Logan Wright, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, it's Halloween this Sunday, and so in the spirit of the season, we've invited Bloomberg Economics' best vampire hunters and monster slayers to tell us about the biggest risks, the scariest risks, facing the global economy and markets. Very pleased to be joined by Chief US Economist Anna Wong, dialing in from Washington, D.C., Senior UK Economist Dan Hansen, joining us from London, and Chief Emerging Markets Economist Ziad Daoud, dialing in from Dubai. Ziad, let's start with you. Tell us about the beastly problem facing the emerging markets.
So we know two things from history. We know the first thing is that rising US rates have a negative spillover to emerging markets. And the second thing is that weaker economies in the developing world get hit harder. We saw that repeatedly in recent years, including the 2013 taper tantrum. We saw it also in the 2018 emerging market crisis. Now, US rates are rising and some emerging markets are vulnerable this time around. So who's the most exposed? Well, it's the group of countries that we group under the acronym BEAST. These are Brazil, Egypt, Argentina, South Africa, and Turkey. These economies have low foreign exchange reserves, have high external debt, and sizable current account deficits. And they're particularly exposed if you get any surprises in terms of interest rates in the US.
Now, fans of the horror genre will know that often the sequel is gorier than the original. In the UK, in 1978, we had strikes, shortages, garbage, even corpses piling up in the street. The crisis was so bad it became known as the Winter of Discontent. Dan Hansen, does the UK now face Winter of Discontent, the return?
We've had a year of two halves in the UK. We've had a blistering recovery following the end of the lockdown earlier in the year. But since then, the economy has slowed. And much of that has been due to, as you mentioned, supply constraints, both global and domestic as well. And they've really hindered the ability of the economy to make meaningful further progress. And we've had a look at what recent supply disruptions might cost the economy, and we think it could knock as much as 1.3% off the level of GDP by the end of the year. And it could add as much as 0.4 percentage point to headline inflation, which, as we know, is already pretty high in the UK. It's running at about 3.1% at the moment. And I think if we look ahead, it's important to recognise that that loss of growth momentum has occurred at a time when more headwinds are appearing on the horizon. Inflation's likely to go higher still on energy prices this winter, moving above 4%, more than doubling the Bank of England's target. That will crimp real income growth. And meanwhile, you've got fiscal support being tapered, and there's also a risk of a rise in unemployment following the end of the furlough scheme, which is the government's wage support scheme. So if we bring all of that together, it's not hard to see why references to stagflation are on the rise, though we don't think we're quite there yet. Our baseline view is that the economy will continue to grow, albeit at a significantly slower pace than in earlier in the year. And our baseline also sees GDP passing its pre-virus peak in the first quarter of next year, which is a little bit later than we previously envisaged.
Sometimes in horror films, the problem gets so bad that the heroes have to adopt a scorched earth policy to wiping out the villains. Remember Ripley in Aliens, promising to take off and nuke the entire site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. Anna Wong, has inflation in the United States reached that proportion? Should we be worried that the Federal Reserve will have to lift off and nuke the economy from orbit to bring price pressure under control?
So indeed, everybody is worried about inflation here. Even my nanny is worried about inflation. And the risk of inflation moving higher than the Fed prediction right now seems higher than a couple weeks ago, indeed. But to me, the scarier scenario is not so much inflation running away to the level we have seen in 1970s, because for that to happen, the Fed has to make policy errors for many, many years. And I just don't think that's likely. The Fed will raise rates next year if inflation runs hotter, than much hotter than they expected. But the real scary thing is what happens to the economy when the Fed does move. Under the new policy framework, the Fed is only going to move until the labor market is really hot, right? So when they do finally start to move, they have to move faster and quicker, and the path of Fed rates will be steeper. And we have had 2 years of very easy conditions, monetary conditions. We have many bubbles now. We have asset record highs in many asset markets. So when the Fed brings this party to a halt, it will be very hard. And historically, the Fed does not have a very good track record in engineering soft lending.
Okay, let's round this section out by talking about perhaps the biggest fear out there for some investors, the fear that record highs for the stock market are the sign of a bubble and that that bubble could burst. Ziad, how should we think about that risk?
Right. So the main question is whether the stock market is in a bubble or not right now, with the S&P 500 index hitting record highs. So to answer this question, we use an econometric model that estimates the likelihood of a bubble based on the speed of decoupling of equity prices from their fundamentals, in this case is dividends. The method finds that we are on the cusp of a bubble. We're not in a bubble territory yet, but we are very close. Now, economically speaking, the direct effect of a sharp correction in the stock market on the US economy might not be very large. But at a time where we have other risks, such as the spreading of the coronavirus variants, the rise of global interest rates, the slowdown in the Chinese economy, and the disruption in the supply chains, adding another risk in the form of an asset price bubble would compound these risks and add an additional layer of uncertainty to the global economy.
Well, Anna, Dan, and Ziad didn't enter into the Halloween spirit quite as fully as I did, but then I guess on a show like this, it's really economic expertise that counts. And that's about all we have time for on this week's Stephanomics. So as the door of the crypt creaks closed, it only remains for me to thank our contributors, Tom Warlock, Logan White and Demon Chu, Ziad Dead, the ghost of Anna May Wong, and Dan Hangsum. Producer Magnus The Thing Henriksen and executive producer Mike The Exorcist Sasso. Join us next week when regular host Stephanie Flanders will be back, the guest host nightmare will be over, and normal standards of economic analysis and editorial judgment will be restored.